for that, et cetera?
Yeah.
Everyone's happy. Okay, that's good, I guess. A little surprising, but good. In that case, I guess we can get started on today's lecture. So next Monday is a holiday, family day. So I was going to start on the topic for next week today. So next week, mostly we're going to cover quantum algorithms. So today, I'd kind of give a warm-up by explaining kind of the context of all of this and what kind of question we'd like to solve by talking about basic complexity theory. So it's all just kind of classical computer science today with, you know, a little bit of token quantum mechanics in there just to keep you interested. So the basic question that complexity theory wants to answer is, what are hard problems and what are difficult problems? And of course, you're talking about computational problems. So what's the difference between a hard computational problem and an easy computational problem? And which ones are which? So first of all, when you think of this question, it seems like a pretty straightforward question, right? A computational problem is hard if it takes a long time to solve it. And it's easy if you can solve it in a short time. If you start to examine this more closely and try to, you know, pin down rigorously what it means to be hard or easy, it becomes a little bit more questionable exactly what you mean. So, for instance, how exactly do you quantify the amount of difficulty? Right? Do you say, how long does it take a computer to solve this problem? Well, that's not really a great answer because it's as much a property of the computer as it is of the problem, right? Every, you know, few years, we get new, faster computers that can solve problems in less time, the same problem in less time than the previous computer. Okay, so that seems like not a good quantity. But one thing maybe that seems a little bit better and is at least a step closer to the solution is to say how many computational steps we need to solve the problem, how many gates we need. And that at least doesn't depend on how fast each gate is performed in your computer. So that's an improvement. But it still has a couple of problems with it as a definition. So first of all, the exact number of computational steps is not invariant depending on what your computer is. Right? It'll depend a bit on the underlying operating system and architecture. So for instance, in this gate network model that we've been using for quantum circuits, the exact set of universal gates you start out with is going to matter when you want to count the exact number of steps, right? So for instance, I mentioned, I think, yesterday that the controlled phase gate, which in this case is 1, 1, 1, minus 1, you know, can be written maybe like this as one gate, but it could also be written as the following circuit with Hadamard on the second qubit, and then a controlled knot, and then another Hadamard. So here we have, you know, if controlled phase is one of our basic gates, it just takes one gate to do this. But if we're stuck with Hadamard and controlled knot, then it takes three gates. Of course, if what we really want to do is a C knot, then we're better off with a C knot as part of our universal set of gates. Whereas if we have to build it out of the controlled phase, then it takes three gates, right? So, so this is going to cause small differences in the number of steps that you need to solve a problem, depending on exactly what your universal gate set is. And it turns out there's lots of other details like that are going to alter the amount of time that's needed to solve a problem. And more than that, when you look at a single computational problem, like, you know, what are the factors of some particular large number, that problem has an answer, right? And once you've figured out that answer, you can easily write a computer program that will spit it out in a very short amount of time, in a very short amount of computational steps, right? So the fact that a program exists that solves this problem very quickly is not really very helpful if you didn't know the answer already, because to write this program, you have to know the answer. But the point is that if you want to say, what is the shortest program that solves this problem, well, the answer is very small. Right? Or what is the quickest, the program that solves this problem the quickest? And that's a very small number, because there exists a program. It's just very hard to find. Okay. So the solution that computer scientists have come up with is you don't try to define the complexity of a single problem. Okay? Instead, you define the complexity of a class of problems. So I mentioned factoring, because that'll come up next week. And so for factoring, you don't say, what is the complexity of factoring some single particular number? You say, what is the complexity of factoring any number? Okay? And that at least solves this problem of, you know, a quick program that will answer one particular thing, but doesn't really help you for factoring other numbers. And the other issues we'll get to in a minute. So first, let me make some definitions. So this notation, 0, 1, with a star up here, is used to denote a bit string of arbitrary length. It's the set, actually, of bit strings. And then a language is a subset. So it's some set of bit strings of varying lengths. Could be any length. And so the interpretation here is so this set of bit strings is the set of possible inputs to your computational problem. And then the language L is basically the set of yes answers. And of course, that only makes sense if your original question is a yes-no question. And yes-no questions are referred to as decision problems. Because you're trying to make a decision between two alternatives. So let's do a quick example of that. Too many Qs. So for primality testing, the language is the set of positive integers such that p is prime. Okay? So you're given an arbitrary positive integer, which can be written as a bit string, right, just by writing it in binary. And then it's in the language if it's a prime number. It's not in the language if it's not a prime number. Okay? And so your decision problem is to say whether it's prime or not. In other words, to say whether this bit string that you're given is in L. Okay? Yeah.
So you say a language is a set of yes answers, but you also say a language is a subset of all the strings?
Yes.
So do you just mean the language is the strings which, if you put them in your black box, are going to give you a yes answer?
Yes, that's right. Okay. 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 So the next definition So an algorithm is a computational procedure. So it's going to be, in the way we've been talking about it, it's going to be not just some particular sequence of gates, but a family of things that will take any input in the allowed set, in this case all bit strings, and usually we parameterize this family of circuits by the size of the input. And we say that the algorithm decides a language L if for all possible inputs, not necessarily in the language, we have two possibilities. And those two possibilities correspond to whether X is in the language or not in the language. So if X is in the language, the algorithm could say yes. And if it's not in the language, it could say no. Okay. So A of X equals 0, which would mean no, if X is not in the language. And A of X could be 1, or yes, if X is in the language. Okay? So basically, this is just saying that the algorithm A of X does what you think it should do to figure out the answer to this computational problem. So in this case, the input here, X, is an instance. To underline instance of the language L. So for instance, if we're given a number, you know, a positive integer, we can say it's an instance of primality testing. That works for any positive number. It's just that when we're thinking about primality testing, we're thinking about it as an example of this particular problem. So it's maybe, in this particular case, it's maybe a little bit confusing because you think of numbers as lots of different things. I mean, you can run lots of different algorithms on them, right? Lots of different questions you might ask about a number. Is it even? You know, is it prime? Is it bigger than 27? Things like that. And those are all different languages. And the same number can be instances of all of these different languages, okay? And of course, the case where it's prime means that it's a yes instance of primality testing. And the case where it's composite means it's a no instance. And so that's what, if we have an algorithm to decide an X, sorry, to decide primality testing, it should say whether P is prime or composite. Now, in some other languages we'll be talking about, the instances have kind of more structure to them. So in some cases that you can still write them as kind of arbitrary bit strings, but you have to interpret those bit strings in some more complicated way. The other thing is that sometimes we'll be talking about cases where there really is a restriction on the set of bit strings that you're interested in. And those are called promise problems. And in that case, the instance is not drawn from a set of arbitrary bit strings, is instead drawn from some subset. Okay? And the subset encodes the promise. So, for instance, I mean, in primality testing, there's no real need, but you could restrict primality testing with the promise that the number that you're given is odd. Okay? So that would be a promise. And then you wouldn't have to have an algorithm that works for even numbers. You just wouldn't worry about them. Okay? Now, that's kind of silly for two reasons. One, because it's really easy to handle even numbers. If it's 2, it's prime. If it's not 2 and it's even, then it's not prime. But the other reason it's actually kind of dumb is that there's a way of encoding odd numbers using every bit string. Right? So there's no real need, even with this promise, there's no real need to treat it as a promise problem. And the answer is simply, well, we interpret our bit string as k, and then the odd number we're talking about is actually 2k plus 1. Okay? So that's maybe an indication that this notion of 0, 1 star as a set of possible inputs is a little bit subtle, right? Because you can be encoding a much more complicated structure as a series of bits. So the distinction between promise problems and non-promise problems, it's important to some computer scientists, but we're not going to worry about it too much. I just wanted to put it out there because we will actually be talking about some things which really have to be promise problems. Okay, so are there any questions so far? Okay, this is just basic definitions really so far. So let's now get to the more interesting stuff, which is how do you actually define complexity of different kinds of problems? So now that we have the basic tools, what we'd like to be able to say is a problem is hard if the best algorithm to decide it. So let's, by problems, let's restrict to languages and decision problems. And we can say a decision problem is hard if the best algorithm that decides it is a small one involving a small number of circuits, a small number of gates, or a large one involving a large number of gates. Okay? And the point is that since now there's many, many possible inputs here, we can't just say a fixed number of gates, right? Because the algorithm is actually a family of circuits that change depending on the size of the problem. So what we really want to do is we want to define complexity as the asymptotic difficulty of this family A of X. Okay, so for primality testing, there's the kind of the obvious algorithm takes quite a long time, because the most obvious algorithm is to try dividing stuff in. This is actually a very old algorithm, the sieve of Eratosthenes, right? You divide by 2, and you see if that works. You divide by 3, you see if that works. You don't really need to divide by 4, since if it's not divisible by 2, it's not divisible by 4. Then you have to divide by 5, right? So you try all the smaller prime numbers and, you know, keep track of which ones are prime because you've built up this list already. And eventually, you'll either run out of primes and decide that this is prime, or you'll find something that divides it, and then you'll know it's composite. Okay, so that algorithm certainly works, but, you know, it particularly if you divide by every number rather than just every prime number, it'll take a time that's, you know, roughly p. But it turns out there's actually much, much, much faster algorithms that take a time that's, I don't actually know the best value, but it's something like log p to the 6th or something like that. for a deterministic algorithm. Okay? So you see that when P is extremely large, like, you know, thousands of digits long, well, doing an algorithm that takes time P, that's outrageous. You're never going to do that, right? 10 to the 1,000 is way too many computational steps. But a few thousand to the sixth, well, that's actually a lot. You probably don't want to do that. There's actually even a better randomized algorithm. But it's much more plausible. Okay? So this primality testing problem people consider to be relatively easy because it has such so I'll get to that in a second. So again, we want to, by asymptotic difficulty, so we mean for large values of the input size. So then getting back to some of those issues I raised before. So we've handled the problem of, well, let's write a stupid algorithm that solves one instance of the problem very quickly and then doesn't do anything for the other instances. So we insist that the algorithm has to solve all the instances, okay, even the hardest ones. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is the exact number of steps involved is still going to depend on the number of gates. Okay? So if you insist on the exact behavior of the best algorithm, that's something that is still going to depend on the machine and not on the problem itself. Right? Because, you know, if you write an algorithm that uses lots of C0 gates, but then you switch to a machine that does the controlled phase gate as its basic operation, well, then the number of steps might multiply by 3. Okay? And so if you insist on saying what exactly the best asymptotic scaling is, you're going to be out of luck. And what's more than that, there's other ways that it can change that are even worse. So this changing from one universal set of gates to another universal set of gates, that's a constant factor, in this case, 3. If you go to kind of more different machine architectures, you can get much bigger things. So for instance, we talked yesterday about the difference between like a 1D computer and a computer where any number of bits could, any pair of bits could interact, right? And if you do that, well, if you have a 1D computer, you can always get a pair of bits to interact by moving one bit or one qubit from one end of the computer to the other end, where it can interact with this bit on the other end, and then move it back. Okay? But doing that, you have to swap it past this bit, and swap it past this bit, and swap it past this bit. And that takes n steps to move it here, and then n more steps to move it back. So it's possible that in this one-dimensional computer, or quantum computer, every gate you want to do takes n steps from your fundamental operations, which are only between nearest neighbor things. Okay? So that's an example of how the number of steps can depend not just by a constant factor, but by a polynomial factor, in this case, n. Did you say you would have to or you wouldn't have to?
Wouldn't.
Would not have to, that's right. So in the ion trap, you can do a direct interaction between any two ions in the same trap. But remember, there's a limit to how many ions you can put in a single trap. So if you have a really big quantum computer, well, again, it's unclear exactly how you're going to build up this big quantum computer. But for instance, if you have a bunch of small traps that are connected together by light, then in that case, you know, it takes only one step to interact two qubits in the same trap. But to interact two qubits in separate traps, you have to first create an EPR pair and then teleport. And so that's some constant number of steps. Now, in that case, the light, I mean, the travel time is probably negligible to connect up different ion traps. So it's not too bad, right? It's just then a constant amount of time to interact two qubits in different traps. In the version where you have to actually physically move the ions around in and out of the trap, then it might go back to a linear time, depending on, you know, exactly your geometry of how you do this. So it depends a little bit on the details of the large-scale architecture of this ion trap. But yeah, in principle, the ion trap is nice because it does give you, you're not restricted just to nearest neighbor interactions. You can interact a pretty large set of ions directly. I should say, though, that there's a couple of drawbacks of that. So one of them is that you can only interact one pair of ions at the same time, whereas in some of these other machines, you can interact, you know, all pairs of qubits at the same time. You get kind of parallel computation, which is important when you get into fault tolerance, actually. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So with this last caveat in mind, that changing the machine is going to change the detailed complexity by some polynomial factor, we can define complexity classes to take that into account. So first, a complexity class abstractly is just a set of languages. And so, of course, you can define lots of sets of languages. Some of them are not going to be very interesting, but a few of them will be interesting. And so we want to define the interesting complexity classes as being a set of languages that all kind of have similar difficulty. So in particular, perhaps the most important language is P. And P stands for polynomial time. So P is actually the name of the complexity class. Polynomial time is just kind of the motivation for the name. And so P is the complexity class consisting of languages L for which there exists an algorithm A sub L, deciding L, and it should decide L in a time at most FL of the input size. And FL is some polynomial. OK? So for instance, if you have an algorithm that solves the problem in time n cubed, where n is the input size, that's OK. If it's time 2 to the square root of n, that's not OK. But of course, as I said, in primality testing, you have to look at the best algorithm, right? So for primality testing, the input is P, So the input size is log p, right? Because if you write out p in binary, it takes log p bits to do that. Okay? So the dumb algorithm that takes time p, that's exponential in the input size, right? Because it's p is 2 to the log p. But the smarter algorithm, that's whatever it is, log p to the 6th, that's a polynomial time algorithm. Okay? And if you go to a different machine that's somehow optimized for primality testing and it takes only time log p to the 3rd, well, that doesn't really change whether it's in p or not, the complexity class p, because log p to the 6th and log p to the 3rd are both polynomial functions. Okay? And so that's the motivation here, is that when you switch to different kinds of machines, the exact polynomial that appears here is going to change. Okay? But because it only changes by a polynomial factor, it won't change whether this problem is in P or not in P. Okay? Does everyone get that? Okay. So various things to note. When we do this, we insist that the algorithm get every instance of the problem correct. Okay? So for instance, here's an algorithm for primality testing which is pretty good, but doesn't always work. I guess I was going to mention this next week, but there's a Fermat's theorem. This is not Fermat's last theorem. This is little Fermat theorem, which says that if you take x to the p, that's equal to x mod p for all x. Okay? And if you just stick in random x's here and use a number here that's not prime, the odds are pretty good that you'll quickly find one that doesn't satisfy this. Okay? So that's a potential algorithm for testing whether a number is prime. You pick random x's less than p, you calculate x to the p mod p, and you see whether you get x again. And for most numbers, that will work. It will quickly tell you whether or not this number is prime. But it turns out there's some numbers called pseudoprimes, which are not prime, but have the property that x to the p is equal to x for every value of x. Yeah?
Quickly tell you whether a number is prime. Like, obviously, if you get something that's right, not x back, then you know it's not a prime. But like, it doesn't really quickly tell you that it's prime unless you've tried all the numbers.
So that's right. So this algorithm that I'm mentioning is actually a randomized algorithm. Okay. So it doesn't answer this question with 100% probability, but it will answer it with high probability, and it can be arbitrarily high. We'll need to talk about this question a little bit in the context of quantum algorithms in a minute. But right. So when I say that the algorithm could always be correct, there's two ways that you can interpret that. So one is you can say it's a deterministic algorithm. It should give you the answer with 100% probability. And so this algorithm is not deterministic. But the problem is that this algorithm is also not actually correct. And the reason it's not correct is because, like I said, there are these pseudoprimes where no matter how many x's you try, even if you try all of them, you'll still see that x to the p is equal to x mod p. I mean, it's not prime, so maybe I shouldn't use p. But the point is that the algorithm will have a 0% probability of being correct for that input. So these algorithms need to work for the worst case. Now, it turns out there's a randomized algorithm that is correct for primality testing, which is quite good and is the one that people use in practice. Which is kind of built on this, but more sophisticated. And it takes care of these pseudoprimes. And so you can you can actually test for a prime number by doing this, and then you do, you know, if this doesn't work, just show that it's not prime, you do a couple more tests, and you can conclude with very high probability for any number whether or not it's prime. Okay. And the other thing is that the running time that we're counting is also for the worst case, right? So if you have some algorithm which for most numbers converges very quickly and gives you the answer, but for some inputs takes a very, very long time, well, that's an algorithm that takes a very, very long time. Okay? We're not averaging over the inputs or anything like that. So there's a whole separate notion of average case complexity, but it's pretty complicated, and we're not going to talk about that. Okay. And so semantically, here, we think of P as the class of languages that can be solved efficiently. And in computer science parlance, efficiency is usually just means polynomial time. Okay? Okay. So the other thing to note is that there are some languages which actually not only cannot be solved efficiently, but can't be solved at all. Okay, and the most famous example of this, and the one that was used to prove it originally, is the halting problem. So the halting problem, you're given input, which is basically some computer program. And the question is, does X halt after some finite amount of time? Right? So for instance, a program that goes into an infinite loop doesn't halt, whereas one that, you know, does 10 steps and then prints out the output, that does halt. The other way it cannot halt is, you know, it might keep on. For instance, a program that counts, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that will never halt, right, because there's infinitely many numbers. And so this seems like a useful thing to be able to do if you're debugging, for instance. If you could solve this halting problem, you could run the program and decide whether your program that you're working on is ever going to finish or not. But it turns out there's actually not just no efficient algorithm to solve this, there's no algorithm at all. Okay? And that's a very interesting and subtle topic. I don't have a whole lot to say about that. But if you think about this, this might worry you a lot, actually. Because remember I said that when we have different machines, the complexity might change. And in principle, I mean, if you're starting from scratch to develop the theory of computation, you might worry, and people did worry, whether the notion of what languages are decidable or not is going to depend on the type of computer you have. Okay? And as far as we know, it does not. And this is codified in something called the Church-Turing thesis. So the set of which says that the set of computable functions is the same for any physically reasonable computer. So you'll notice the weasel words physically reasonable in here. So it's hard to describe it. I mean, it's not a theorem. It has more the nature of, you know, physical laws that we write down, you know, like conservation of energy. As far as we know that's true, okay? But you can come up with weird situations in which energy is not conserved. You can certainly come up with you know, open systems where energy is not conserved. That's a whole, I mean, I guess I shouldn't have mentioned that at all. But the point is, this is not something that's susceptible to proof. It's just something that seems to be true for all the computers that people have come up with. Now, you can come up with some computers that are physically not reasonable that actually have different sets of computable functions. And sometimes it's kind of surprising. So for instance, if you look at analog computation, but you allow infinite precision, that actually can compute some uncomputable functions in the standard model relative to, you know, standard computation. Okay? So clearly that's not reasonable to have infinite precision. But maybe looking at it, it wasn't so obvious that it was ridiculously unreasonable, right? It's just, you know, maybe you're being a little sloppy. Yeah?
Is it safe for a quantum computer?
Yes, so that's a very good question. And this is still true for the quantum computer. And how can you tell that? Well, a quantum computer, what does it do? Each quantum gate is a matrix, right? And if we have n qubits, it could be a 2 to the n by 2 to the n dimensional matrix. But to compute the output of a quantum computer, all you need to do is multiply a bunch of 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrices. It takes a long time, but it can be computed. So anything you can compute on a quantum computer, you can compute on a classical computer just by multiplying the matrices. Okay? So quantum computers do not challenge this thesis at all. And in some sense, they support it, right? Because here we have something that looks like a very different model of computation, potentially stronger, but it still satisfies this condition. Okay? But that brings up the next point. Which is that if you're talking about the complexity of problems, you need something stronger than this. You need to know not just that the set of computable functions doesn't change, but that their complexity isn't changed by too much. And so classical computer scientists had come up with a strengthening of this Church-Turing thesis, sometimes also called the modern Church-Turing thesis. And this says that the complexity of problems in any physically reasonable computer differ by only polynomial factors. And so even before quantum computing, there were actually some minor challenges to this. It's not clear if randomized computation with randomized algorithms is computationally equivalent to deterministic algorithms. Okay, so a computer that can flip random bits might be slightly more powerful, computationally speaking, than a computer which cannot. Everyone thought, well, maybe that was just a small bug in definition. And actually, I think probably a majority of people today think that there isn't even any difference in their complexity. Primality testing, I guess I erased that. Primality testing was for a long time the standard example of a problem which seemed easier, in the P versus polynomial versus not polynomial sense, easier on a randomized computer because it was a good randomized algorithm. And for a long time, people had no deterministic algorithm that was polynomial time. But actually, a deterministic algorithm was discovered, I guess it's now a bit more than 10 years ago, roughly 10 years ago. Sorry, a bit less than 10 years ago, about 10 years ago, was a deterministic algorithm for primality testing. And there's some other kind of theoretical considerations that suggest that that randomized polynomial time could be the same as polynomial time. So, so basically, most classical computer scientists believe this strong Church Turing thesis in some form or another. But quantum computers really present a challenge to it. And while quantum computers don't break the original Church Turing thesis, they do seem to violate the strong Church Turing thesis. Okay, and so that's why, conceptually speaking, the fact that quantum computers can solve some problems much faster than a classical computer is really, a big blow to the conceptual foundations of computer science, and it's really a big deal for theoretical computer scientists. To the extent that I think there's some well-known theoretical computer scientists who just refuse to believe that a quantum computer can work because it would violate the strong Church-Turing thesis. Yeah.
So could we, in principle, someday find like a quantum P algorithm for an NP complete problem?
Maybe. So that's something we'll be discussing kind of over the next week. The best thinking right now is no, but we don't know that for sure. Let's see, how much time do I have? So I probably, so I'm not even going to have time to define NP today, but maybe we can talk a little bit more about it on Tuesday, and then towards the end of next week when we talk about Grover's algorithm, I'm gonna come back to it and say one of the reasons why we don't think it's possible. Okay. So then let me finish by defining actually quantum polynomial time. So we haven't discarded this complexity class P, which is what you can do on a classical computer in polynomial time, because classical computers are still kind of interesting. Even if someday we have quantum computers, classical, it's still a kind of interesting special case of quantum computation. But we define a new complexity class that's going to codify what a quantum computer can do. That's called BQP. And so the BQP here, again, BQP is the name of the complexity class, but it does stand for something. There's a logic behind this name. And the B is bounded. The Q, you can probably figure out, is quantum. And the P is still polynomial. So the bounded is the only one I think that needs a lot of explanation. And that has to do with the fact that quantum measurements are always going to be random. So a quantum algorithm is not generally going to give you the answer 100% or 0%. It's going to give you with some probability correct. And so the bounded makes sure that we quantify that correctly. So let me define this. So it's a class of languages L, decidable by a quantum algorithm. So first of all, AL of x should run in polynomial time. On the worst case, again. So that part is the same as in classical algorithms. And then here we get to the probabilistic conditions. So if x is in the language, well then AL of x should output 1, but we don't insist that it do it 100% of the time. We insist that it does with probability at least 2/3. Okay? And if x is not in the language, AL of x should output. So this is maybe not good notation, because AL of x is a random variable. So what I mean by this is that it outputs a random variable with that, in this particular case, has this value. In any case, so in the no case, where x is not an L, then it should output 0 with probability at least 2/3. OK? So the bounded here means that there's bounds on these error probabilities. In this case, I picked 2/3. It's not really very important. The important thing is that this probably not be a half. Okay, because if it's a half, it's just like it's guessing randomly. And if it has to be, in particular, it has to be bounded away from a half. And the reason for that is, well, if you have something that runs with probability 2/3, say, and you run it 2 times, or 3 times is probably better, and you take the majority of those, well, now the probability of being correct will be greater than 2/3, right? And in general, you can amplify the success probability exponentially by repeating the algorithm. Yeah. No. I mean that the probability of being wrong will decrease exponentially as a function of the number of times you repeat it. Okay. So you only need to so if you want to get to some, you know, probability 1 minus epsilon of being correct, then you need to repeat it about log epsilon time, log 1 over epsilon times. Okay. Now, if you insist that epsilon be really, 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 really small, then that might still be a large number. But generally, you know, you can get epsilon to be extremely small with just a modest number of repetitions. Okay? But the problem is that if this is too close to 1/2, then, you know, exponentials are great once you start to get, you know, numbers of reasonable size. But if the original probability of success is incredibly small, you know, if it's exponentially small to start with, then you actually have to repeat very many times before you can get it to a reasonable size and the exponential really starts to kick in. Okay, so that's why we need this bounded probability. Okay? So are there questions on that? Yeah?
Why exactly what?
2/3. Oh, like I said, it doesn't really matter. It can be any number, so long as it's, you know, different, substantially different from 1/2. If it's, you know, 1/2 plus something exponentially small in the problem size, that's bad. But, you know, 2/3 is okay. 3/5 would be okay. 51 hundredths would be okay. Right? So long as it's a constant, then we can amplify it whatever we like by repeating the algorithm. Yeah?
So are all quantum algorithms always going to be probabilistic?
Yes and no. So you can, for certain problems, you can usually tweak the algorithm so that it becomes 100% correct or 0%. Of course, in practice, that's not going to be an issue anyway because, you know, there'll be small errors in your machine, and so that might cause the wrong answer. Usually, in fact, to tweak the success probabilities correctly, you need to use some irrational numbers, you know, rotations by irrational angles. There may be certain specific values in which nice regular gates will give you the right answer 100% or 0%. And the first algorithm we'll see next week, the Deutsch-Grosse algorithm, actually does give you 100% or 0%. But it's the typical case that they're random. So I could say that if it succeeds with probability 1, then that still satisfies this definition, right? 1 is greater than 2/3, so that's fine. It's just we don't insist on that. So yeah, maybe, so you could define a different complexity class that insists that the probability be exactly 1 of getting the right answer. But that complexity class is now not going to be robust against these small changes in definition, whereas this BQP is robust, right? And in particular, if you change the set of universal gates from something that lets you exactly realize any unitary to something that only approximately lets you realize a unitary, then, you know, your 100% success probability might go down to simply 100% minus epsilon, where you can control epsilon, but it's never going to reach 100%. Okay, so that would be an example of a class that's not a good definition because it does depend on the exact kind of machine you pick. Okay. Okay. Probably not enough time to start a new topic at this point. So if there's any more questions, I can take them. Yeah.
No one else is going to ask a question. I didn't really understand what a Pauli's problem is. Could you?
Oh, okay. Well, we'll see some example of that next week with the Deutsch-Grosse algorithm. But let me see if I can come up with a simple example. So a Promise problem is one where you don't have to consider all possible inputs. It's hard to come up with examples that aren't totally contrived. Here's maybe.
It's like, for example, when you're doing a computer program and you're really careful that the user would be really stupid and would input like things that make no sense.
Yeah.
Input, I don't know, a number.
You're restricting the set of possible inputs.
That's right, yeah. Okay, I guess that's not a contrived example. I mean, so you have your primality testing algorithm, and you have a program that says, please input a number, and you want to output whether it's prime or not. But, you know, the computer has a preferred coding for things that doesn't require that it be numbers. It also accepts letters as inputs. And so if you don't explicitly check that it's a number, then the user might put in, you know, 5 written F-I-V-E. And your computer doesn't know what that means, so it'll get confused. Right. And so you promise is kind of that the user will actually input something as numbers. Now, like I said, in this case, there's always, that's technically still a complete problem, not a promise problem, because, you know, there is a way of using every bit string as a number. It's just your computer is not necessarily set up to do that. Okay. So then I guess if that's the last question, then I'll see you next week.
What was the name of the algorithm that we're going to look at next week?
Oh.